I want to welcome you back to our second week in miracles, and we get to start talking about the miracles this week. As we consider the marriage at Cana, the first recorded miracle of Christ, you know, I was reminded that marriage customs really vary greatly from society to society. You go to different places in the world, and their marriage customs greatly differ from ours. Personally, I like the way it's done in the good old USA. When you think of preparation for a marriage, what goes into preparing for the actual wedding ceremony? You know, the groom has to pop the question. My youngest son agonized over getting engaged this summer, not so much as getting engaged as in when and where and how to ask his girlfriend and, you know, making some preparations. But you know, once you ask the question as a guy, you're kind of home free. And that's not bad. Think of what are some of the preparations that have to be made once that question is popped and that date is set? What are some of the preparations that have to be made? Just name something. A place. Who picks the place? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. The bride picks the place. What's something else that has to be planned? The dress. Well, got to have that. Caterer. Who gets to pick the caterer and work with the caterer? You betcha. Caterer, right over here on the bride's side. Honeymoon. I'm going to give that one to the groom. That's really his bivouac. Yeah. Probably that's both of them. What's something else? Flowers. Who gets to pick the flowers? You bet. Who gets to pick that music? I heard music. Yeah, I haven't seen too many grooms pouring over sheet music and interviewing musicians. Well, Seth, there's always an exception. We got another one. Invitations. And who does those invitations? Oh, the bride. The first time I saw my invitation was when my parents received one. I said, oh, those are our invitations. The bride picks the dress, but what does the groom have to wear? But who gets to pick the tux? When Cindy and I got engaged, I was living in the Chicago area going to law school, and Cindy was down living on the coast, down the coast from Galveston. And, of course, she was doing all this. And I flew down Labor Day weekend of 1973, which would be the last time I would go visit her before I married her in December. We tried to keep a distance. But when I got there, she said, the only thing I need you to do is pick out your tux. That's the only thing. I've done everything else. And she said, I'm going to take you to the tux store, and you just pick out the tux. And so we got to the tux store, and I thought I was going to have this array of tuxes. And we got there and she said, now, you only have to pick between these two. I've narrowed it down to these two. So, okay, I can do that. And you know, they're both hanging up. And she said, which one would you like? This one or that one? And I said, I like this one. She said, let me tell you why that won't work. And I realized I wasn't picking the tux. This was a sham. I wasn't picking the tux. You know, the bottom line in our society is once the question is asked and the answer is given and things really get thrown into high gear, it's the bride that's going to do it. You know, I've been involved in weddings as the groom one time. I've been involved in a wedding as the father of the groom one time. I've been involved in a wedding as the father of the bride one time. And I got to tell you, this is a good system. This is a good system. I've experienced it at all levels. But that's not the system everywhere. In fact, 2,000 years ago, in the Holy Land, call it Palestine, call it the Promised Land, call it the Holy Land, their wedding customs were much different. And when we approach the wedding at Cana, when we approach any of the wedding stories, it's important to remember there was a marked difference between their wedding customs and the ones that we enjoy. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a thing. and why it's important that we remember what some of the wedding customs were at that time is that Christ's relationship with the church is always couched in terms of Jewish wedding customs. And so when you think of yourself as being a member of the church, as being part of the bride of Christ, keep in mind that God views us, Christ views us, through the lens, if you will, of Jewish wedding customs. Now, 2,000 years ago, Jewish marriages were arranged. They were contractual relationships. The two families got together. They kind of hammered out the terms of the engagement, the dowry, if there was one. It was an arranged contractual relationship, usually between a man in his mid to late 20s and a girl 15 to 17 years of age. That was kind of how it worked. That was the age gap that was accepted. Once those details were hammered out, the parties were engaged or espoused. You can remember Mary being referred to as Joseph's espoused wife. In the eyes of Jewish society, once you were engaged, you were as good as married. It was marriage without the cohabitation. In fact, to break an engagement or this espousal period, you basically had to go through the same steps as to get a divorce. It was that legally binding in the eyes of Jewish society. It took basically the same horrendous conduct to break that espousal period. Now that period, that engagement period, usually lasted for about a year, give or take a little time, but about a year. And that was a very busy year for the guy. See, it was all on his shoulders. The future groom had the responsibility of planning the wedding. He had the responsibility of planning the wedding supper or the wedding feast that came after the wedding. We'd call it a reception. They called it a feast. Believe me, there was a difference. He also had the responsibility for preparing a place for him and the bride to live in after they got married. He couldn't get married until he had a place for them to live. And normally, this consisted of building a room onto his father's house. Now, doesn't that send chills down your spines, ladies? Oh, we get to live with your folks. How nice. It wasn't unusual for three or four generations to be living under the same roof. So the husband would have to not only build that room, but it would be up to him to decorate that room. The wife was never allowed to see that room until after the marriage took place. She had no real say in how it was built or how it was decorated. She could send things ahead with her friends or family, to her fiancé, to use in the construction or to use in the decoration, but she had to trust her fiancé to build it and decorate it. Think about that, ladies. If your husbands were in charge of building and decorating your home, would you be living in a box under a bridge? We would. A nice box, I like to think. Maybe several boxes stapled together. But it would be a box under a bridge. Now, during the duration of the espousal period was totally up to the groom. It lasted as long as he said it lasted. Like I said, usually a year, give or take. Here's the deal. Once the groom decided that it was time to get married, it was time to get married. And he didn't tell the bride. What would happen is the groom would notify his father and say, "It's time." And the father would say, "That's great." And the groom would get his friends together, the friends of the groom, and they would all go to the bride's house to pick her up. That's it. That's the notice. Ready or not, she's coming home. No invitations. Now, what would normally happen is the groom and his friends would kind of take a circuitous route to the bride's house through the village or through the neighborhood if they lived in the city, blowing horns, making a bunch of noise, and announcing to everyone that this was going to be a wedding, and wasn't this great? That did two things. One, it gave the bride a little heads up. And two, it let the villagers know that there was going to be a wedding and everybody was invited to the wedding feast. See, it was really important that the bride be ready. The bride had to live in a constant state of preparation. Because like I say, when the groom showed up and knocked on the door, there wasn't any slot to open. You didn't need the magic password. It was, "I'm here." And ready or not, the bride would be taken by the groom and his friends to his father's house for the wedding ceremony. And if the bride wasn't prepared, the husband would be shamed before his father and his family. Think about that in relationship to the church's responsibility to be prepared for the return of Christ. The purpose of the bride, while the groom did all this, all the bride had to do was stay ready. Be prepared. The groom would take her back to his father's house. His friends would grab all her worldly possessions and tote them back. There'd be a short wedding ceremony. The marriage would be consummated, and boom, the wedding feast would start. And it was a party. It was a time of joyous celebration. It could last an indefinite period of time. Now, normally it would end on sundown on Friday because the Sabbath would begin then. You couldn't have a wedding feast on the Sabbath. Wealthier people would pick it up the day after the Sabbath when the Sabbath ended and keep it going, but most people ended Friday night at 6 o'clock. That was curfew. And so, if you weren't real rich, you planned on your wedding date accordingly. How long could you afford to feed everybody? And as the curtain rises in John chapter 2, the espousal period is over. The groom has gone and fetched the bride. The wedding ceremony has taken place. The marriage has been consummated. And the party is in full swing. And as we open John and we look at chapter 2, the best man arrives. Oh, he's not denoted as such, but he's the best man. Let's look at John chapter 2, the first 11 verses, and read quickly with me. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus said unto him, they don't have any wine. Jesus said unto her, Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother said to the servants, Whatever he says to you, do it. And there were set there 6 water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus said, Fill the water pots with water. They filled them to the brim. He said unto them, Draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast. They bear it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and knew not whence it was, but the servants knew, the governor called the bridegroom and said, Every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But you have kept the good wine until now. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee. He manifested his glory, and his disciples believed on him. As we begin to walk through these 11 verses very quickly over the next 15 or 20 minutes, it's important to remember that in the Old Testament, the prophets repeatedly characterized Israel's unfaithfulness as what? Adultery and fornication. Israel was repeatedly referred to as an adulterous wife. But even as the prophets condemned Israel, they reminded Israel of the promise of God that in the last days, He would come to Israel as a faithful husband, marry them in effect, and enter into an everlasting covenant with Israel. Now, it comes as no surprise that in the New Testament, Christ carries that over. And there are many wedding stories in the New Testament that Christ relates that have the same theme, only a broader application. I mean, consider in Matthew 25 the story of the wise and foolish virgins. The story in Matthew 22 of the king who gives his son a wedding feast. Nobody shows up. The king sends everybody out, sends his servants out, says, go, fine, bring them in. The story in Matthew 22 where the wedding guest comes, but he's not wearing the appropriate clothes, so he gets the boot. I'm not sure if that's where that television show What Not to Wear came from, but it's possible. It's possible that a godly person was writing What Not to Wear. Or the story of the guests in Luke 14, who chose the highest and lowest places in the wedding. And of course, in the climax of the book of Revelation, chapters 19 and 21, that whole scene in heaven, the marriage of the Lamb, the marriage of the Lamb and His church, and the reflection of really the entire millennial kingdom as being a 1,000-year wedding feast. So constantly and consistently, we see Christ pitched in this messianic role. We see the wedding stories presented with messianic overtones. And it's important that we read them as such. Because Christ is never, in these stories I just related, of course, Christ is never the groom that shows up. Christ isn't the groom at the wedding of Cana. In Mark chapter 2, you might recall in verses 19 and 20, Jesus and his disciples go to another wedding. And the Pharisees confront him and his disciples, and they criticize him, Christ, and his disciples for not fasting. And Jesus said, Why should the wedding party fast when the groom's here? Christ wasn't the groom at that wedding, but he always viewed himself in that messianic role. And whenever we come across a miracle or story in the Bible, in the New Testament especially, that relates to a wedding story, it has to be read with those messianic overtones. Considering our story today, what we just read, it's a very familiar story. Christ isn't the groom here. But what's the focus of the story in those 11 verses? Do we ever hear of the engagement period? No. Do we hear about the terms of the marriage? No. Do we hear about, that neat time where the groom and all his friends went over to the bride's house and picked her up? No. Do we hear about the wedding ceremony? No. Do we even hear about the wedding feast? No. What's the focus? The focus of the story is Jesus Christ. Without Christ, there's no story. So we need to keep those messianic overtones in mind. We also want to talk about or note that this story just is full of great details. It foreshadows the new covenant. It foreshadows the new covenant. It foreshadows the new union of Christ with the church. A union that will be inaugurated on what? The third day. When does this wedding start? The wedding starts in verse 1 on the third day. Now, there's two applications to that. First of all, this wedding started on Tuesday. Obviously, the family figured they can feed them and give them drink Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday till Friday at 6 p.m. But again, if we're foreshadowing, if we're looking at that messianic application, it's the third day. It's the third day. It's also important to note that a couple things about the jars. You know, whenever you read one of these stories, remember, there's no superfluous details. It's not like the Holy Ghost was breathing his word to be written by, in this case, John, and just threw in something for nothing. I want us to remember two things about the jars. First of all, what were the jars used for? In verse 6, there were 6 water pots or jars of stone after the manner of the purifying of the Jews. These jars were used for ritualistic cleansing. Now, we're not going to go there today, but if you go back to Leviticus, if you can't sleep some night and you decide, I'll read some of Leviticus, that usually does it. I should have turned this off before. If you go back and start at chapter 11 and read through chapter 21, it's cleansing after cleansing after cleansing. But those cleansings all had a purpose and a function. Those were for specific rites of purification in the event of coming into contact with something that was unclean, or if you were about to perform a ritual that God had commanded, or for the priests for worship. You go back through those 10, 11 chapters, and there's constant references to cleansing. These jars weren't used for that. It was after the manner of the purifying of the Jews. That denotes it has nothing to do with the law. This is ritual. By the time Christ came on the scene, among other things, cleansing had been so expanded in its application that you basically couldn't walk out the door or in another door without a pot of water being there to cleanse yourself, to wash your hands. External purity or external cleanliness had become the mantra instead of an internally clean heart. This is where holy water comes from. This is the genesis of holy water, that same cleansing. That's why if you go into a Catholic church, there will be some form of holy water. I never knew that. And I was when I was in college, some friends of mine who were Catholic wanted to go to confession before finals, which was, I thought, appropriate knowing how they had lived the entire semester. And I went up with them, not to confess anything, but they had the car, and I wanted to go into town. So we all went up there, and I waited in the little entryway while they went in to confess. and I noticed there was an ashtray by the door. And I went over there, and I poked it, and I thought, but that's not sand. That's a sponge. And I took it out, and I thought, why would they have a sponge? And I wrung it out, and I'm a college freshman. I'm tossing it against the wall. I dropped it a couple times. And I got bored, and I picked it up and put it back in the ashtray, and I went and stood against the wall. And just about that time, a priest comes in, hits that sponge, north, south, east, west, and I thought, oh, good Lord. That's the holy... What would he have done if he came in and I was bouncing the holy water off the wall? Well, I'll tell you, that entryway was sanctified when I was done with it. But this was ritual. This was the ritual that had found its way. It had nothing to do with the law of God. It was ritual. And this ritual, you remember from Christ addressing it, was breaking the backs of every Israelite. It wasn't just the cleansing, but that was one of the rituals. So we have something that was ritualistic. It was a ritualistic cleansing. It had an Old Testament tie-in, but that had been so misconstrued by this time that it had lost its true application. You know, that's easy to do in our churches today. We can look back and say, well, we don't have no holy water. We don't demand cleansing. But you know, the truth is, anything can become ritualistic depending on how we approach it and the priority we give it in our lives and how we interpret it. I'm down at the criminal courthouse in Dallas Monday through Friday every morning, professionally, not personally. I'm a professional cat burglar. But you cannot walk through the halls of the criminal courthouse in any county without seeing people sitting there clutching a Bible. Now, that may be the first time they saw a Bible in 6 months. And sometimes I want to say, why don't you just punch a hole through it, put a chain through it, and wear it around your neck? It's a lucky charm. But you know, prayer can become a ritual for us. Bible study can be a ritual for us. It depends on how we approach it. It depends on how we do it. That's why it's so important what George is talking about in our prayers, that our prayer life not only be consistent, but that it be meaningful, that it be directed, that it not become just ritualistic. I know people, and you know, we all fall into this trap, we kind of have that checklist in our mind as we go through prayer. Got to hit this, 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 and this. You know, once we cover those bases, we're okay. We're okay. Anything can become ritual. That's the first thing about the jars. Second thing, how many of them were there? Six. You know, well, what's the big deal? Six, half a dozen. Six jars, that's a nice even number. In rabbinical writings, numbers were really important. The Jews were huge on numbers. Now, if you've ever looked at biblical numerology, you know that, and again, this is just trivia, the numbers for biblical numerology that they all emphasize are 3, 4, 6, 7, 10, 12, and 40, with 3 and 4 being the base numbers because all the other numbers can be reached at by addition or multiplication of 3 and 4. That's biblical numerology. And it's true that if you go through the Bible, those numbers do seem to repeat themselves. But you know something? It's not part of the theology. It's an exercise if you're snowed in on a Friday afternoon. And really, how many Friday afternoons are you going to get snowed in down here? You're not. But in rabbinical teaching, numbers were extremely important. And the perfect number was 7. That was the number of completeness. That was a number of wholeness, of completion. And when a rabbi wanted to make a point that something was perfect, 7 was the number. So if you were a Pharisee or a scribe, guess what number was really important in your life? 7. And you would have 7 phylacteries to wear. You would have 7 pairs of shoes. You would have 7 sets of dishes. Very important. Very important. Now, if the rabbi wanted to indicate something that was incomplete, something that didn't quite make it, something that really lacked, didn't fill the bill, guess what number they used? 6. That was the number in rabbinical teaching for something that was incomplete, something that didn't just quite make it. Now here we have six jars. The Holy Spirit points it out to John. Six jars which are used for a ritualistic cleansing that has nothing to do, that is incomplete, that is insufficient to bridge that gap between God and man. And Jesus is about to do something with those jars that have a meaningless service. Jesus is about to do a miracle that transforms those jars into a great meaning, that transforms incompleteness to completeness, that represents the gap that's bridged. And isn't that what Christ does with each one of us at the point of salvation? We are like those meaningless jars filled with water. And Christ comes and He changes a six into a seven. That's what He does here. Let's look at the miracle. Just briefly, let's look at the miracle. And as we look at the miracle, let's remember the definition we gave for miracles last week. And I know some of you are saying, well, I wasn't here last week. And others of you are saying, well, I was asleep last week. And others of you are saying, I just didn't care. But I wrote it on the board. Let's remember what our definition of miracles is. And as we go through this miracle, let's see if this fills the bill. It's a direct intervention of God into the ordinary lives of man, apart from, but consistent with His established order to His ultimate revelation and grace. Is this a perfect definition? No. This is the best one I found. A perfect definition would have, I guess, seven parts. But so this only has four. You want incompleteness? I got your incompleteness right here. It only has four parts. But let's look at this. Let's look at this. The miracle is set off by a request from Mary. Virtually all of Christ's miracles are set off by a request from someone. Why? Because like we said last week, God doesn't need miracles. We need miracles. God doesn't need a miracle. We do. You know, considering this was Christ's first recorded miracle, kind of makes you wonder what Mary had seen in His life over the last 30 years that made her think, He can do this. He can do something here. I mean, my mom thinks highly of me most days. But you know something? She would never come up and make a request like this to me. And she's known me for nearly 55 years. Some of them good years. So, it's kicked off by a request from Mary. It's a request for direct intervention. She comes to Christ, and there's a request for direct intervention. She said, they have no wine. It's a request for direct intervention. Jesus' response is interesting. His response is interesting. He's standing there at a wedding, an ordinary occurrence, an everyday occurrence. And He says, woman, of what concern is that to you and me? My hour has not yet come. Jesus referred to His mother as woman two times in the Bible. One is here, one is where? Cross. We got the cross, yeah. In John 19, Jesus looks down from the cross and says to John and Mary as they stand there, woman, behold thy son, son, behold thy mother. Those are the only two times Jesus refers to His mother as woman. That's not a derogatory term, but it's not a term that was customarily used by a man to identify his mother. Even in Jesus' time, this was not a common term. People say, "Oh, that everybody used that." No, they didn't. That was an unusual term. It was a term of distance, of some distance. You know, in his ministry, Christ never denied His family relationships, but what He stressed was, who's the true family? The true family is the family of believers. There's a spiritual family. Christ was trying to expand that view. In fact, in Matthew 12:50, what He said, whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, that's my brother, that's my sister, that's my mother. God has a family perspective that He wants each one of us to adopt. And Christ here is saying, mother. He doesn't say mother, He's saying woman. Woman, it's a term of a little bit of distance. He says, of what concern is that to you and me? Okay, there's a problem. But how is that my problem? Have you ever felt like that? Somebody calls a need out. Maybe it's announced from the pulpit. Maybe you read it in the bulletin. But your response is kind of, okay, how does that relate to me? What is that between you and me? I don't think that's a callous response, but I think it indicates two things. One, this wasn't part of Jesus' agenda. He didn't come to the wedding to perform a miracle. And two, this was not a convenient time, and it was not a convenient place. He said, my hour has not yet come. What's the hour he's referring to? Well, we know his ultimate hour of glorification is on the cross, but that can't be it. It's the hour when he begins to manifest himself as who he is, the Son of God, very God of very God. Because after this, we know he performed many miracles and revealed himself to be the Son of God and very God of very God. So he says, what is it? What is this to you? What is this to me? Look at the act. They set the pots before him. He said, fill them up with water, take it out, and take it to the ruler of the feast. If you had to think of some adjectives to describe the act of the miracle, Jesus said, fill the pots with water, take some out, and give it to the ruler of the feast. That was really the extent of it. How would you describe the act of the miracle if you had to come up with some adjectives? Think about it.
Ordinary.
In what way? In what way was it ordinary? No fireworks, nothing that would call attention. I guess maybe another word would be humble. Well, remember what we talked last week about Christ's inherent authority? That he performed miracles with an air of inherent authority. He performed miracles because he was God. He did not perform miracles because he sought the power of God. He had the inherent authority to perform those miracles. So, casual or inherent authority. What are some other adjectives that come to mind about the miracle? Was it a partial miracle? Or was it complete? It was complete. He provided what was needed, when was needed, when it was needed, and in abundance. He provided more than was necessary. You read different measurements. These jars usually contained about 20 gallons apiece. So we're talking 120 gallons of wine. That's a lot of stuff to drink. In the Old Testament, the writers repeatedly used an abundance of wine as one of the characteristics of the millennial kingdom. Not that there will be great drunkenness, but to denote joy, to denote abundance. Tom? Okay. Required obedience. It was private, wasn't it? Who was aware of this actual miracle? As you look at that account, who was aware of that actual miracle? Servants? Who else? Mary? Who else? And the disciples. Now, who benefited? Everybody. You know, when we do something good, isn't it nice for people to know about it? Isn't that our human nature, that when we do the right thing, we kind of like people to know that we did? Oh, you don't need to give me a plaque, but We just would. Yeah, it was all those things. It was complete. It was private. It was ordinary or humble. It was casual with inherent authority. It required some obedience. It was better than expected. You know, it was superior. Remember what the ruler of the feast said? Where'd you get the good stuff? It was. Yeah. They recognized the difference between good wine and bad wine. And like the ruler of the feast said, usually, you know, you give them the good stuff first and then you slip in the bad stuff because they won't know the difference. Okay. It was direct intervention of God. It was into the ordinary lives of man. It was a wedding. It was apart from but consistent with established order. Christ changed water into what? Wine. He didn't change it into something that no one recognized. When the ruler of the feast was given it, the ruler said, hey, this is great wine. He didn't say, manna? Liquid manna? No. It was consistent with the established order. consistent with the established order. And what's the end result in verse 11? What's the end result of the miracle? His disciples believed. He was glorified, and his disciples believed. So the miracle required the direct intervention of God. It was an ordinary circumstance. It was apart from the established order because water just doesn't get changed into wine. But it was consistent with his established order. He didn't change water into some unknown substance, and it was to his ultimate revelation and glory. But what does this have to do with us? I mean, the wine at Cana was more than just a thirst quencher, although for most of the people at the wedding feast, that's all it was. And you know, the Bible tells us that the gospel, for most of the people who hear it, for most of the people who live on this earth, the gospel will be nothing more than a thirst quencher. But for those who truly recognize what it is and embrace it, it's so much more, just like the wine at Cana. While most of the wedding guests just had their thirst quenched, it made a difference. It made a difference, I submit, to the disciples. It made a difference to Christ. It made a difference to Mary. It made a difference to those servants. But what does that have to do with me? I mean, apart from this, there's not going to be water turned into wine today. I'm not even going to try. I want us to look at two things very quickly in the time we have left. First of all, I want to look at Mary's request to God. And this really goes along in part with what George was talking about in our prayers. Look at Mary's request. What did Mary ask Jesus to do? How did she approach him? What did she say? Hey, I want you to do this. What did she ask? What did she ask Christ to do? She identified a need. Without a specific, solution. This goes along with what George is saying. And what Tom talked about this morning. When we approach God, how do we approach Him? When we have needs, don't we usually have suggestions? I know so often I do. If someone's sick, I'd like to tell God to make them well. If someone's out of work, I'd like them back at work immediately, please. If someone's having trouble with a child, I can have a suggestion about that. What was Mary's approach? She identified a need without a specific solution, but what was there underlying her identification of the need? There was the expectation of a response. Look at that. Do we approach God with that expectation? When we bring our petitions before God, is there, underlying that presentation, the expectation, the heartfelt, grounded expectation that there will be an answer, that there will be a response? Mary came expecting a response without dictating a solution. That's not a bad approach in our prayer lives. To approach with the expectation of a response without dictating a solution. Because you know what happens when we dictate a solution? What is our response if that's not the solution? Disappointment, anger, maybe we just don't bring it up again. We, too often I think, as Christians, as believers, it's true in my life, almost get proprietary about our requests. Because, now, God, not only have I told you what the problem is, I've told you what the solution is, and while I admit I can't work out that solution, I know you can. And so, now, here I step back. I've given you the question, I've given you the answer, now you put those two together. And when it doesn't happen, then we're disappointed. Then we think, well, you know, is it God? Is it my prayer life? I'd also like us to consider Christ's attitude and approach to meeting Mary's request. How would you describe Christ's response? And it wasn't mean, because we know this is Christ. And it wasn't petty because we know this is Christ. But if you looked at Christ's response, what did this tell you about his initial reaction to Mary's observation? Yeah. Kind of not a priority. What else? Mm-hmm. It's a control issue. You know, the only other time in the Bible that this phrase, "What is this between you and me," is used, that terminology? Can you think of the one other time in the Bible that that's used? Interestingly, it's used in Mark 1:27 when Jesus is casting out demons, and the demons say to him, "Son of God, what is this between you and us? What's the problem?" I'm not saying Jesus, you know, quoted here. I'm just saying that's the only other time in the Bible that's used. Was this part of his plan? Yeah, our time is not yet come, and Jesus here is saying, "My hour is not yet come. What is this between you and me?" That's it. Was this a convenient time for Christ to do this? From Christ's perspective, does it seem like this was convenient, part of the program? I think this was an inconvenient need. You know, it seems fairly obvious that Christ had not intended to come to the marriage at Cana and perform a miracle. Had he wanted to manifest himself as the Son of God at this point, why would the miracle have been so quietly and humbly performed? I mean, if the point is, I want everybody to know, you know, this is the kickoff to the ministry, and I want everybody to know this is, you know, the big banquet, you go out into the middle. And you say, "Hey, we're out of wine, bring me the water." You don't stay back in the kitchen and say, "Fill it up with water, take it to the feast, take it to the ruler of the feast." It's not convenient. It's inconvenient. What's our response to inconvenient need? As human beings, what's our response to inconvenient need? What? Give me one. Just let someone else do it. Why do we avoid inconvenient need? Pride? What's something else? We're too busy. We have lives. I suggest laziness. Yeah, no payback. There's a lot of reasons why we can come up with for not meeting inconvenient needs. I have needs of my own, you know. I meet my needs. I don't bother other people with my problems. Come on. Suck it up. You know, be a man. Handle it. You know, God says we're to meet inconvenient needs. Proverbs 3:27 says, "Don't withhold good from someone when it's in the power of your hand to do it." That's a very convicting verse if you look at it. If God has given you the ability to do good, we're not to withhold it. Tom noted in James today, verse 17, what? To him who knows to do good and doesn't do it, to him it's sin. That applies to need, to those who know that it is good to meet a need for someone else and do not do it. To them it's sin. And that's hard. Meeting inconvenient needs is hard. We touched on this. What's even harder than meeting an inconvenient need? We talked about it. Who noticed? Who noticed? We said the disciples, Mary, and a couple servants. That's all. no payback. Why do we want notice when we do the right thing? You ever think about that? Why do we want notice? Why is it important to us that people acknowledge that not only, you know, that we did the right thing? Feels good? Yeah. There's a little ego there. We're swell people. And what about human nature? It's very self-directed. Dig a little deeper. Why else do we want somebody to know when we did something good? It elevates us. Righteousness, popularity. There's a lot of payoffs to getting recognized. How about this one? Then next time it'll be somebody else's turn. Ever think about that? I mean, if everybody knows I did this big thing, or I did this, well, you know, the next time a need comes up, they can do it. You know, I had my turn at bat. I don't have to meet every need. If people just know the ones I meet, then maybe expectations are, well, yeah, they did that next time. Let's let somebody else do it. There's a lot of payoffs that we want from recognition. It feels good. It swells us. Our egos are fed. Human nature is self-directed. It makes us look better than other people. It makes us popular. It makes us righteous. Maybe it advances us in our church or in our job or in our circle of friends. There's personal advantage. Oh, they're a great man. That's a great woman. You know, let's let them be the leader. Christ, in performing this miracle, as we looked at, it was a quiet miracle. It was a humble miracle. The people who benefited the most physically had no idea who did it. There was no payback for Christ. His disciples believed. Last of all. You know, when Jesus said, Jesus recognized, I wrote this down so I wouldn't forget it, and with my memory, that's why I do it. We want credit where credit is due, and that can really taint our motives for doing the right thing. And Jesus recognized this in Matthew 6, 3, and 4. He talked to his disciples about their almsgiving. And you know, when we think of almsgiving, we think of that's money. But almsgiving in the Bible is actually the commission of any righteous act. When you read about almsgiving in the Bible, it can apply to money, but it can apply to any righteous act. And Jesus said, when you do your alms, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Do it in secret. Your Father will see it. He'll reward you. Who's the audience Christ says we play to? That's always the audience. It's always an audience of one. And Christ drives that home with his disciples. Remember who you're playing to. We play to everybody around us. Jesus says, you're playing to an audience of one. And finally, how did Christ meet the need? Did he meet it? Exceedingly, abundantly. He didn't just make the minimum, did he? It was an exceeding response. I heard a speaker one time who said, if God responded to your needs the way you respond to the needs of others, how miserable would your life be? I've never forgotten that. If God responded to your needs the way you respond to the needs of others, in that same measure, how miserable would your life be? Christ responded abundantly. We're to respond abundantly. Why? Because, you know, while we look at someone in need, before God, we're all in need, aren't we? Every one of us is destitute before God. We have what we have because God gave it to us. And that is the only way. And we will have it just as long as God wants us to have it. And that applies to our health. That applies to our jobs. That applies to our possessions. That applies to the people around us. We have those things and enjoy those things only by the grace of God and only for so long as God says you may have them. We're to provide exceedingly. In what measure do we reach out? Do we meet minimum goals? Do we reach minimum needs? Or do we stretch to provide more than the least that is needed? George Bernard Shaw, not a great theologian, but I like this quote. This is the true joy in life, being used for a purpose, being used to better, to aid another instead of being a selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. This week, inconvenience yourself. Look to meet an inconvenient need. Look around you. There are inconvenient needs all over. Remember your audience. You're playing to an audience of one. When you meet that need, meet it quietly. And finally, provide as God has provided for you. Don't look to do the least you can. Look to provide as God has provided for you. That's the miracle of Cana. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, we praise you because you abundantly provide for us. In the worst circumstances of our lives, we can look around and still we have to acknowledge your abundant provision. Lord, may we reach out to others as you've reached out to us. May we be willing to inconvenience ourselves for those around us. May we always remember, Lord God, that whatever we do for your approval, for your praise, and for your glory. And Lord, may we not look to do the least we can do. May we look to do the most that you enable us. And may we do this all to your honor and glory. And we pray this in your name. Amen.